of Malta's Minute with the Catechism.
Radio for Catholic and other Christians. This is 990 WDEO, Ypsilanti, Detroit, or on the internet at WDEO.net.
This is D.L. Hudson. Welcome to Church and Culture. This show is devoted to exploring the interaction between our faith and our culture. Each week, I will talk with expert guests on topics ranging from literature, art, and music to politics, liturgy, spirituality, and education. Thank you for joining us. My guest today is a very special lady I've known for a number of years, Dr. Ann Hendershot. She's been at the front lines of the pro-life battle for many, many years. She's written what's one of the very best books on the issue called The Politics of Abortion, which was published in 2006. It was very helpful to me when I wrote my book on religion and politics. She is presently Professor of Sociology and Director of the Veritas Center for Ethics and Public Life at the Franciscan University of Steubenville, but she's also simultaneously distinguished Visiting Professor of Public Policy at King's College in New York City. Ann Hendershot, welcome to Church and Culture.
Well, thanks so much. I'm happy to be on your show.
You know, you've written a number of other books with titles like The Politics of Deviance, Status Envy, The Politics of Catholic Higher Education, most recently, Renewal, How a New Generation of Catholic Priests and Bishops Have Revitalized the Church. I'm going to go with that title for a second.
Okay.
Because I agree with the title. There is a new generation of what I call John Paul II priests and bishops. But right now we're in the middle of a presidential election where we have one clearly pro-abortion candidate and one, okay, call him shaky pro-life candidate. Fair enough.
No, I wouldn't call him shaky.
Well, I wouldn't either, but I'm just saying that for my listeners' sake.
Okay.
Okay. And yet we're getting voter guides from certain dioceses that are very, very misleading. They don't really show to the extent to which Clinton is pro-abort. And they sort of, you know, Donald Trump's claims. We have only a handful of outspoken bishops' comments on the election. Not that they're trying to endorse anybody, but trying to show that the abortion issue should be at the top of the list of what Catholic voters consider. It's one of the, as some people say, non-negotiables. I prefer the word settled. One of the settled issues in the church. Just to an outside observer, it doesn't look like this new generation of priests and bishops are anywhere near being in charge. Is that fair or unfair?
Oh, I know. The title of the book was true when I wrote it. I was thinking that that trend was going to continue because we had so many really courageous bishops
who
seemed to be stepping up. Corleone, Olmsted. And they still are.
You got Jugas in the middle of that Charlotte mess right now.
We have some wonderful,
yes, we
wonderful
do.
Bishops.
You got Bishop Sheridan, Bishop Vashon. I don't want to leave anybody out, but
so
these are the ones that come
back. I want to take the book back. But, you know, papal elections have consequences, too. And some of the new appointees, like the one in San Diego, I'm not going to say that he's
a
problem, but he just came out with a statement saying that we should just kind of forget about intrinsic evil when we start voting. But Bishop McElroy's been a problem for a while. He was an auxiliary up in Northern California for a while, and he wanted to change the USCCB voting guide to reflect the new values of the Catholic Church.
Pope Francis, and Pope Francis, by the way. Let me ask you to respond to something. I'm talking with Ann Hendershot, who is I'm going to have to go look. Okay, professor of sociology and director of the Veritas Center for Ethics and Public Life at Franciscan University, as well as distinguished professor of public policy at King's College in New York City. This happened today. A friend of mine, someone who actually works with me, and it was on Facebook, and a priest whose church is only blocks down the road from her, it's not her parish, took a meme that I created where I have Cardinal O'Connor saying that I don't think any Catholic in good conscience could vote for a candidate who publicly supports abortion, put it up and linked it to Trump, saying that Trump was a pro-abort and that Cardinal O'Connor's statement would apply to him, didn't mention Hillary. And then this woman went on and argued, and this priest began to berate her, call her a racist. I mean, this was public, and just was over the top with stinging personal jibes and criticism. Now, I bring this up because I know, because I'm in touch with lots of grassroots Catholic voters, this is not an isolated occurrence. What's going on?
No, it's not isolated, and I think you probably have experienced yourself, as have I. It seems like people have been given permission, I don't know where that permission came from exactly, to berate those who disagree with them.
Yeah.
Father Peter West and I were recently on Twitter called extremists on abortion because...
Not ultra-extremists?
Yes.
You haven't gotten to the top of the heap yet.
Yes. So this is, and that was by a professor at Fordham that called us.
Oh, yes.
And then when we asked him why he saw us, that he blocked us both from his Twitter page and Facebook.
So, well, you know, I think St. Thomas Aquinas says about virtue of charity that there's no extreme, there's no mean. It's all there's only the extreme. The more extreme, the better.
I guess. Well, that's. But in the abortion, in the pro-life world, to be called an extremist kind of lumps you in with the clinic bombers, and he knew that, and that's why it's a code word for us. You know,
it is.
Extremists. We try not to be among the extremists. We want to love everyone, especially the unborn child, but we don't want to fight. And I certainly wasn't up for a fight until he called me an extremist, and then I'm happy to join the fight.
Yeah, but you're a gentle lady, and I try to be a gentle man, but sometimes you just got to fight. It's not pleasant. It's not pleasant, and I like to play by Queensbury rules even when I fight, but I don't even get that treatment.
No.
It's just nasty, and you're a sociologist. Let's go back to your comment that people seem to have gotten permission. What do you think, what has happened in the Catholic world community to create that sense of permission?
Well, it'd be too easy to blame Pope Francis. This is really not his fault at all.
I agree.
It isn't. And a lot of people have been blaming the Francis effect because of his comment on who am I to judge and his comment on we don't want to obsess about abortion.
And also his comment on Trump himself.
Yes, I know. I mean, none of those are exactly profiles in courage. But there's not the reason for this. It's certainly not the reason for this. But there are some bishops that are emerging as leaders in the church now with very big voices who are giving permission to priests who want that permission already, who have already gone to that other side. And now they're empowered. So they're trying to cow some of us in the pews into thinking that we are the extremists and we are the deviants when we haven't changed our beliefs at all. And the church hasn't changed her teaching at all.
And I wonder if you've had this experience. As you know, I've been fighting these political Catholic battles now for two decades. And I've been on the TV and the radio and all that and, you know, commented back and forth. I find there are some very delightful liberals, call them that, progressives,
sure,
who fight in a way that is entirely satisfactory in my view. I might think they're dead wrong, but it never gets nasty. It never gets personal.
Yeah.
But it seems like there's this growing number of folks who think it's perfectly fine to get nasty. In fact, when Hillary Clinton, you know, described Trump supporters, or half of them, as deplorable,
I know.
Isn't that exactly a sign of the kind of rudeness you're talking about?
Certainly. And this really isn't new. This really was started in the Obama administration, of demonizing the other, anyone who didn't agree with them. And you got that, a lot of that throughout the last election, and we both did.
Yes.
So this is nothing new. What's new is it's coming from our own church, and that's what's so disturbing to me, that people within our own church, as your friend's priest, feel free to attack us because, as I am, I'm supporting Donald Trump as the only pro-life candidate for president that we have. And I don't see how we have a choice.
Yes, and you have personally endorsed. Of course, that doesn't reflect any of your institutional connections. And it's interesting. I mean, this young woman was in tears on the phone with me. I mean, she's lived in this neighborhood of Georgia, Atlanta, Georgia, for 25 years. She's served every church, every school, raised money. She's had priests live in her basement. She's doctored elderly priests out at the Monastery of the Holy Spirit. I mean, she's
a good person.
Yeah, and there she is, attacked and called a racist. I mean, I couldn't really calm her down. She was so upset.
Well, that's too bad. But, you know, I think what we're going to have to do as Catholics is be like venue shoppers. We're going to have to look for the faithful priests and the faithful bishop. I'd like to move to Phoenix, and I think those people left out there with Bishop Olmstead. I mean,
well, and you know, Charlotte and a lot of other places.
Abortion. Yeah,
you know, and a lot of places are, you know, a mix of good and not so good. Some places are just downright bad. We won't talk about those, but. Even in the downright bad places, you're going to find now great priests and great lay people. It's interesting, Anne, as a sociologist, it's my observation that sometimes in the places that are the most hostile to Orthodox Catholicism, you find some of the most articulate and grounded defenders of the faith. Is there a reason for that?
Oh, absolutely. And, yes, we see that. The book that I did looked at those kinds of issues. Why is it that some dioceses have just so many ordinations and other dioceses have none? And we won't talk about the ones that have none, because I think people realize what's wrong in those dioceses. But it comes down to leadership. If you have an inspiring bishop, a charismatic bishop, and by charisma, I don't mean like jolly and happy. Cardinal Dolan is charismatic, a wonderful man, but I don't mean that kind of charisma.
Yes.
I mean holy, like Bishop Olmstead.
Yeah.
He has made a plea to voters, say no votes for abortion. And they have lots of vocations in that diocese because people are inspired by that.
Same thing's true out in Omaha.
Oh, absolutely.
And, you know, I did stories in Crisis Magazine about the crisis of vocations, and did study of all the dioceses and their vocations. And there were three or four around the country that hadn't had a vocation in 10 years.
I know. Yeah, sad places like Rochester, Albany.
I think if Walker Percy were alive, he would say something like this. He would say, "Aunt, does anyone want to enter the church to be a social worker?
No.
Does anyone want to enter the church to be a psychiatrist? No. That's not. They want to enter the church to be holy priests.
They do.
That's the calling."
And they want somebody to lead who is holy and will inspire them. They don't want a social worker leading them. And the bishops who talk all about the wonderful social work things they do are not inspiring vocations. In fact, they're turning them away. That's the saddest part. But it seems intuitive to me. people want to become priests to serve God, not to serve the state. You know, and too often we have become the servants of the state with George Soros money lately. But this has always been a problem, always. You and I were talking about this when health care was being passed. Remember, so many of the bishops were trying to get the Affordable Care Act because it was such a good thing to do for people.
Although they issued a statement that they didn't want an Affordable Care Act that funded abortion. They did issue a statement,
yes,
but they only issued a statement.
And they didn't do anything further than that. And
yeah,
they allowed Sister Carol Keehan to do what she did.
Who, by the way, is still a trustee on the board of Catholic Charities. And I want to mention that because you mentioned about serving the state. I was just looking up some stats this morning, and I saw that between 2011 and 2015, that 68% of the Catholic Charities budget nationally, not the diocese, nationally, came from federal contracts.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what, again, as a sociologist, what kind of impact did that have on the culture at Catholic Charities?
Well, when they're paying you, you have to do what they want. You know, they're your funder. And so that's why when we say we fund all these charities, we don't fund these charities. The state funds these charities. We're the money launderer. And we have fealty to them. The Catholic Charities is honoring Hillary Clinton at a banquet. That's unbelievable to me, right before an election like this. And that's scandalous.
Well, the only thing that is defensible about that is that this is the Al Smith dinner that we're talking about. And there was an article at Life News which was very misleading. It made it sound like there was a dinner other than the Al Smith dinner.
Oh, no.
And the Al Smith dinner is, as you know, always invite both candidates. And so Trump will be there. And have you ever attended any of those?
No, I haven't.
Okay, I've been to a couple. And they really are roasts. I mean, the candidates roast themselves. And I'll tell you, the year Al Gore was there, I almost fell off my chair. The guy was so funny. You wouldn't have believed it was Al Gore. He was hilarious, and Bush was almost just as funny. But so it's misleading to say that they're honoring her in a special way because they've got Trump there too. But the point is that pro-abort Catholics gets honored all the time by all kinds of institutions, all the universities, right?
Well, I think it's kind of a problem, though, to give her equal time with the pro-life candidate because to me I just find it a problem. Because everybody thinks she's terrific then, you know?
Yes. Yeah, there is it gives her cover.
It does.
And
President Obama was honored the same way. It's an honor. I don't think you can say it's not an honor. But you're right, it wouldn't be fair to just have one and not the other. But I think it should be made clear that she is the pro-abortion candidate.
Well, and of course there are there's three Catholic conferences, state Catholic conferences that have issued an identical candidate comparison, which flat out misrepresents Hillary's position on abortion.
Bishops are trying to distance themselves from that, though.
I hope so.
Because it is the conference, and the conference is always far left.
Well, the conference has distanced itself from the state conferences because a lady in the pro-life office, who was a student of mine years ago, Anne.
Oh, really?
Called me and said, we had nothing to do with this. We knew nothing about it. And I believe her.
Yeah, I believe her, too.
This was a product of folks within the state Catholic conferences. And as far as I can see, they haven't taken them down yet.
No.
I've been encouraging people to go on Facebook and make comments under the Virginia Catholic Conference, Florida Catholic Conference. And, of course, Pennsylvania has issued it, but they haven't put it on their Facebook page yet.
Oh, well.
Now, we're not exactly going to – it's not like New York's state hangs in the balance here, right, with the Al Smith dinner.
No. No, but it gets national attention. It'll be on the news.
Oh, yes.
And she'll be sitting next to Cardinal Dolan.
Yes.
And laughing and having fun. That's what bothers me about those dinners.
Yeah. They can be used for photo op purposes, right?
Yes. That's the problem with them.
And, you know, there you know the history? There were two instances in which, well, one instance in which Cardinal O'Connor simply didn't invite any candidates. This was the year that Ferraro was the
Fielding
vice
Ferraro,
president.
I remember that, yes.
Yeah. And then another year in which, I think under Egan, the dinner again didn't invite the candidates. So there have been years in which Cardinal Archbishop of New York have just said enough is enough.
Yeah, I wish they had done that this year. Because Hillary Clinton, in terms of abortion, her record is horrible. And what she's promising is even worse. To do away with the Hyde Amendment so that all of our taxpayer money will be paying for abortion, not just, you know. And the platform, the Democratic platform that she's running on and supporting is worrisome. And she has promised to change our teachings. I mean, she has a statement that says churches have to change their teachings. And she was talking about abortion.
Yeah, it's in order to allow women to have abortions. I mean,
yes.
I just don't get it. I mean, she, you know, when Bill Clinton was running, it was safe, legal, and rare. Safe, legal, and rare, right?
Right.
And so when the state Catholic conferences describe her position on abortion, they say legal and rare. Legal and rare.
Really?
As if that's their her position. Rare. How can you say rare in relation to her?
You can't, because she wants to expand abortion by making the high
yes.
gone. And have us pay for more abortion, make it easier to get abortions, overturn all of the state-level restrictions that we've put on abortion, the hard-won state level. She wants to overturn all that. So then she's going to sit in a picture with Cardinal Dolan, I don't understand that, to tell you the truth.
I've known Cardinal Dolan since the days he was back at the North American College in Rome. I knew him when he was took down the very tough job in Milwaukee. Did a great job up there. And he's gone to a place which, frankly, is a challenge to the best of us.
He is.
And I admire his attempt to use his bonhomie, his, well-met person. I think that's important in the church.
It's a charm.
We don't have enough of that, I think, especially among us.
I admire that. He's one of our heroes in my book.
Yeah, especially among so-called conservatives. We come across too much, even though we're not.
Cranky.
Cranky. I'm not cranky.
Well, no, I don't think you are, but we're kind of known for being cranky, because at least, in fact, when people meet me, they say, you're really not.
Oh, it happened to me, too. I had one group, Voice of America, I attended Cardinal Law's last Mass in Boston, and just to show support for him.
Yeah.
And I met a bunch of Voice of America people protesting. They recognized me. They surrounded me. And one lady looked at me and said, I thought you would be old, shriveled, and ugly. Well, I am now, but I wasn't then.
Yeah. So funny.
But you've had the same thing.
Oh, all the time. They'll say, I didn't know what to expect. As if to say, you'd just be so mean, like fire would be coming out of my eyes or something.
Now, what kind of would this be like academic conference, or where do you get this?
Oh, no, when I speak at meetings or even at Catholic meetings very often, people just expect me to be much meaner.
Gosh.
I guess.
Where did that start? Because you and I both know the pro-abortion leaders in this country, going back to Phyllis Schlafly. And, of course, she got started not with abortion. She got started with
equal rights.
Equal rights.
Right.
Who is there somebody to blame for that?
I don't know. I don't think so. It's just the conservatives are, because we are traditional and we kind of want to hold on and conserve things that work, we must be viewed as rigid and doctrinaire, and that comes across in some of our writing, perhaps. I try not to use all the mean words, but sometimes you got to tell the truth.
Yeah, I mean, I try to use humor to kill, the way Friedrich Nietzsche talked about.
I love your writing.
And I try that, but at some point, you got to call a spade a spade. But I do find that the pro-abort crowd is very, very surprised when you employ humor.
They just don't expect it.
They don't know how to deal with it, and they certainly don't have laugh lines in return.
No. They're pretty programmed. I was on Al Jazeera earlier last year, and a very young, beautiful girl was debating me, and I know that I was chosen as the old, you know, withered,
very attractive,
pro-life person,
very attractive
and
older woman.
Yes, it was. She was from Cosmopolitan magazine, so not only was she young and beautiful, but she was very cool and hip. But we ended up having an actually very nice conversation, and
yeah.
The host could not have been nicer.
It
worked out fine. But
I've had great experiences on Al Jazeera. I think they're gone now.
I know. I'm sad about that because I ended up going back several times to be on their show. They were more fair than
very classy. Very classy.
Yes.
Yeah.
So I'm disappointed they're gone.
And
but they set up arguments that way. Usually the conservative is old and mean. You know,
Greta Sustern is the classiest interviewer I've ever had.
I'm disappointed.
She actually did her homework. Whenever I talk
always,
to her.
Always, and was fair.
Yeah, you know, and she asked good questions. You know, and I got treated well on MSNBC when I covered the Pope's funeral.
That was brave of you. I've never done that.
No, I mean, they were really, I mean, I don't know what it was. I think the guy liked my tie or something, and he was just really nice to me. Well, I'm talking with Ann Hendershot, and we're talking about, obviously, this election cycle and the culture and how the church is being impacted by it, and it's impacting it. And we'll be right back with Dr. Ann Hendershot from Franciscan University and King's College after this short break.
It's time for Family Man with Dr. Gregory Popchuk.
We all know that consistency is important for our children's well-being, but a recent study in the Journal of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry shows just how true that is. Researchers found that young children who experienced multiple moods and school changes had up to a 60% greater risk for exhibiting serious mental health problems in adolescence, including psychosis. Consistency in a child's life isn't just key, it's critical. Our church teaches us that human beings need ritual to be healthy and happy. Rather than being boring, repetitious actions, rituals bring order, meaning, and peace to our daily lives. Multiple moves and school changes disrupt the rituals that allow children to develop the ability to regulate their emotional, psychological, and relational lives. To give your kids an advantage, work hard to keep up rituals like family meals, game nights, family prayer, family days, and of course, Sunday Mass as a family. I'm Dr. Greg Popchuk, but you can call me Family Man.
To discover more ways faith can enrich your life, visit CatholicCounselors.com.
Where is the tallest statue in the world of Our Lady of Guadalupe? You will be amazed to find out. Hi, I'm Peggy Stanton. Join me on Power from the Pews to find out the answer and the remarkable story behind the statue. That's this Saturday at 11 a.m. and Sunday at 9:30 a.m. on Ave Maria Radio and AveMariaRadio.net.
If you've enjoyed Father John Ricardo's gift of teaching and preaching in the past, his new book, Heaven Starts Now, is the book for you. In his inspiring and incisive way, Father John addresses the obstacles we all face in becoming mature disciples. How do we learn to forgive? How do we combat fear and understand suffering? How do we worship the Lord, love others, and surrender our lives to God? How do we become saints day by day? Order online at AveMariaRadio.net under the store tab. That's AveMariaRadio.net under the store tab.
I'm back with Dr. Professor Ann Hendershot, much published expert on matters of sociology, Catholic Church, abortion, cultural trends, and you wrote a book back in 2004, which I think is very prophetic. It's called The Politics of Deviance. And now, 12 years later, we're witnessing this national debate over who uses bathrooms, whether we should all get in there together, including our LGBT brothers and sisters. Is this an example of the kind of politics of deviance that you were talking about?
Exactly, it is, yes. The book was actually inspired by Daniel Patrick Moynihan, kind of a hero of mine. I know he's a Democrat.
But that's okay. That's okay. It's allowed.
A good man. And he once spoke at one of our meetings, national meetings, talking about defining deviancy down, about how behaviors that were certainly aberrant in the past are now becoming normalized. And he pointed to inner city, having children out of wedlock, how that was becoming normalized and how that would be a problem. He predicted that when large numbers of families are headed by women without a male father figure present, that those communities were bound to disintegrate. And we're seeing that today in North Carolina right now in those riots that are occurring. But he also predicted it in other ways. And I think we're seeing that played out in the LGBTQ community with this transgender issue. And this has been coming for a long time. The community has a lot of money, and they're able to sell, and there is marketing involved. My book talks about the kind of marketing of a new definition of deviance, removing the old label of deviance and replacing with a label of normal. And so we saw it in the gay rights movement after Stonewall, the selling of deviance and this acceptance. And now we're seeing it in the transgender community, something that I really didn't even predict when I wrote this book in 2004. I'm pretty shocked by it, to tell you the truth, that it went so fast. It's so quick. In the New York Times just this past weekend on Sunday's Times, there's an article by a woman who bought a dress for her son, who was 6 years old, so that he could play dress up and put on plays and puppet theaters. And then he decided he liked the dress so much that he decided that he's maybe going to be a girl. And she let him wear the dress to school, and now he's a girl. He grew his hair long, and that's so crazy, you know. But it was an editorial in the New York Times, and she's congratulating herself as a mom for being so open and so accepting to allow her son to wear a dress to the first day of first grade. And he did. Now, if a child wore a dress the first day of first grade, DCYS would have been making a phone call to that family if that had happened 15 years ago. And you know it. That child would have been viewed as a potential abuse situation. But we have defined deviancy down so far that that woman is lauded as a hero on the pages of the New York Times.
When's the last time you, Ann Hendershot, were lauded a hero on the pages of the New York Times?
Yeah, I don't get lauded on the New York Times. I can't even get an op-ed into the New York Times.
Let me ask you this.
Buy your son a sparkly green dress and have him wear it to first grade, then you're a hero.
I mean, I'm older than you are. I think so. And when I look back at my childhood in the 50s, Ozzie and Harriet, Donna Reed Show, Father Knows Best, Danny Thomas, Perry Como, you know, Andy Williams, Bob Hope, Ed Sullivan, right?
Right. I know.
I feel like we're living in a world of science fiction that somebody made up and doesn't, you know, that it's all a dream and we're going to wake up and it's not real. I mean, how did this actually get traction
with marketing techniques? It really is, and especially the gay community. In fact, there's a book, After the Ball, in which Kirk and Madsen, two marketing experts, psychology majors, helped us sell a new definition of gay and lesbian behavior. They wrote that book in the disastrous decade of the 80s in the middle of the AIDS epidemic and said, help people look at us as victims. We got AIDS through no fault of our own. This just occurred to us in our community, and people feel sorry for us. So we'll have some movies. We'll put up some posters, and all of a sudden, they go from being a despised minority, and nobody wants to go back to those days. I mean, you and I certainly know that late-night TV was filled with horrible jokes against gay men, suffering gay men. We don't want to go back to those days, but now, they used to say they just wanted a place at the table, and that's all changed. Now they really want to run the table and run people who are of faith, who don't believe that same-sex marriage is a good thing, out of the table. They're not welcome at the table anymore. So they want the table. They didn't want just a place at the table.
I remember in the first year of the Bush administration, a friend of mine, Scott Block, got appointed. He was the counsel that was independent, who was the inspector of all the federal government. He had a tenured kind of position. He couldn't be removed. Appointed by Bush, Catholic pro-lifer. And he made some move regarding the gay community, and he ended up out of his job, a job that he wasn't supposed to be able to move, simply because of what the Human Rights Campaign was able to do to him.
Oh, they can destroy you. And they have destroyed many people.
They're really good at what they do.
They're very good at what they do. They're very good. And there's a lot of money in that community, so that they're able to fund these kinds of attacks on people who are trying to make life difficult or just want to assert their own independence from this. You know, Archbishop Corleone out in San Francisco has had a real hard time last year when he wanted to change the strengthen the policy manual to say that we want Catholic teachings on marriage to be taught in the schools, and people went crazy trying to attack him. And those attacks were well-funded by two gay billionaires. I don't want to put their names on the radio, but those attacks were very well-funded.
How much of the traction do you think occurred because of the creation of very happy gay and lesbian characters in TV series?
Well, that's all part of the marketing. Get them their own TV shows, because they're Will and Grace. You know, those are great shows.
Yeah, Will and Grace, I think, was very, very influential.
It was, absolutely.
And, you know, I watched it and laughed. Nice. And,
you know, there was no subtext of boas and heels and, you know, and nobody talks about any of the behavior.
Or AIDS.
Wants to talk about that. And we certainly don't either.
Yeah.
But once you leave that out, there's, you know, the marketing is easy, because we all know wonderful gay people. We know them. They're in our family.
Yeah, well, they've created a stereotype on TV now. The gay character, like in Nurse Jackie, which is a series I love.
Right.
The two gay characters are the constantly happy, the constantly quipping,
right,
the sort of never have a bad moment. They may have a bad moment, but then they laugh it off.
Mm-hmm.
It's as if the normal heterosexual problems that heterosexuals experience never happen to gay people.
No, unless you look at the actual psychological statistics and the sociological data. Transgender, this Chelsea Manning thing, she attempted suicide. As you know, your listeners must remember, she was the one who's serving a 35-year sentence in prison because of, you know, the Espionage Act. She stole secrets and disseminated them. But he, when he did that, he was Bradley Manning, and now he's having a sex change in prison and attempted suicide during the summer.
Who's paying
and
for that?
I wrote about that because 41% of transgendered individuals attempt suicide. You don't ever hear that statistic anywhere, do you? But that's a major study that's been done. I mean, the regular public, only 4% attempt suicide, but 41% of all transgenders. So this isn't a happy time, even though they're portrayed that way on TV. They're not so happy and jolly and gay.
Well, and it seems to me that that may be changing over time. There may be a settling down to, you know, gay characters don't have to, you know, be part of the marketing.
Yeah, maybe.
You know, and that's the way it should be. But I'll tell you another stereotype that we're finding on TV, which I think is having a huge impact, is all parents are stupid, especially the fathers.
Yeah, and that started a while ago, though, with Married with Children, you know, the buffoon of a father. But really, that's always been kind of around, but it's even more obvious now. The fathers are always dopes.
I don't feel like I'm dope. I mean,
but not when Fathers Knows Best and Donna Reed. The fathers were professionals.
Well, they were kind of omniscient. You know, never made a bad move.
No, but there were still some of those fathers. I don't know if you ever heard of The Honeymooners. Probably none of your listeners have.
It's my absolute favorite television show of all time. I own on DVD every episode, even the lost episodes.
Oh, yeah, they're great.
Yes.
He was kind of a buffoon, but he was lovable and sweet, and he loved his wife.
I love the boom, zoom, you know, little moment there, you know. And, of course, Alice, she never gets upset. She just turns it to her own advantage, right?
I know she did, because he was so emotional. He was like the female in the partnership. So we've had these kind of characters for a while, but he was lovable, and he was completely redeemable, and he supported the family even as a bus driver. And she was able to stay home. It was a very nice show. Really was a nice show. But he wasn't perfect, that's for sure.
And it was filmed before a live audience.
Was it really? I didn't know that.
And it was, you know, unfailingly hilarious. It was never
hilarious.
Profane.
In a while, there'd be a biblical quotation. Once our Carney Norton was stuck between a pipe, two pipes. He somehow got stuck fixing something, and he said, the spirit is, or Ralph did, and he said, the spirit is willing, but the flesh is just too much, and Ralph was kind of fat. It was very funny.
Yes. And so, again, we have, and I think in this election, because I went to this meeting with Trump in New York City in the summer.
Oh, you did? You were there.
Yeah, and it was mostly evangelicals, but I managed to crowd a few Catholics in at the last minute. And, you know, Trump would say things like, you know, I want America to be the kind of place where football coaches can pray with their team. I want the America that I grew up, you know, as a boy, you know, where we saluted the flag and we sang that, you know, we meant it. It's my view that this election is about culture change, and it's about people who want their culture back.
Yeah, and it's not just nostalgia. I mean, our culture is around us now. West Point coach, my son went to West Point, so I've been keeping up
with
the story. The West Point coach just got in a lot of trouble. And he's a wonderful coach, and they're having a winning year. So
for what?
Go Army.
What do you get in trouble for?
He got in trouble for praying with his team after a game, the first game of the year. They won, and he thanked God, and somebody complained. One of the players told his mother, and his mother went crazy. And then Nikki Weinstein, who has been after the service academies to take God out of the service academies, because he doesn't like God there. He doesn't think that soldiers need God, but I guess he's never been to war. And so, yes, we want that back. Yes.
How much trouble? What do you remember the coach's name? Because I didn't see
Monk.
That.
Monk. He hasn't been fired or anything. He just
sounds Catholic.
That he would never pray with the team again.
He said that?
So the second game, one of the players, I go to all the Army games. My husband and I have season tickets, and we go to all the Army games. Yeah, he won the second game, and then after the game, one of his players was killed tragically in an auto accident. And I thought, how sad that he can't pray with his team now to pray for that young soul who was killed. He can no longer pray after games.
That just almost leaves me speechless.
Me too, because God is very present at West Point and all the service academies, no matter how much Mickey Weinstein wants to keep him out. But he is like a one-man wrecking crew when it comes to religion at the service academies.
And
he's got his own, like...
And you know, it seems to me that someplace like West Point has such tradition...
Oh, I know.
...that they would be able to resist some of this.
They can. He had to apologize. The coach apologized, and there's no more prayer after the games. It's very sad to me.
Can you wear a crucifix?
I don't know. I don't know how far they're going. But when they eat at the mess hall, all the cadets eat at one time. My son graduated in 2007, so I know at that time they all prayed before they ate, all at the same time. And I don't know if that's allowed anymore either. I don't think
there's any way they can prohibit an individual from praying.
I'm sure not, but this wasn't just individual.
Yeah, it was corporate.
Mm-hmm.
I was hoping to feel better after I talked to you.
Sorry. Well, there are still pockets of holiness. I mean, just think that the coach did want to have prayer, so you know that that's a great coach. That's what I have more respect for him.
Now, so how much do you think the election reflects this kind of conflict in our culture?
Oh, I think it's everything. I just do. I think that those of us who are supporting Trump, For me, it's the life issue for sure, number one.
Yeah, number
but it
one.
Isn't just the life issue. It's the other assaults on our culture, especially our religious freedom. Hillary has promised that she's going to change church teachings. She said that. That's a major assault on us. That goes to the core of who we are as individuals. And I don't know how people who know that she said that, that I'm just not making this up, how they can't rally behind Trump. Because I certainly am. It's not easy either. You know?
No, I mean, yeah, I've taken some blowback. But
who cares?
I mean, if you posed it to, let's say you had a group of Catholics who more or less were Democrats and more or less were supporting Hillary. If you posed it just the way you did now to them, what kind of response would you get? You may have already experienced it.
I have experienced it. They call me a single-issue voter because of the life issue, which to me is foundational. I don't know how you can look at it. And the attacks on religious liberty, they see as a figment of my imagination because they have not heard her say that. They have not read the text of her speech where she said that. But I don't even think you have to read that. You have to look at what President Obama's been doing, the HHS mandate. Look at the Little Sisters of the Poor. You think that's not going to continue, that attack?
You know, and the Little Sisters of the Poor are going to put out a PSA. They're going to put out a PSA.
Won't be able to be Catholic anymore. If she's going to change church teaching, do you think that we could keep out a gay student who wants to room with his gay spouse? Do you think that? We couldn't happen.
Sorry for interrupting. I was trying to say that you mentioned the Little Sisters of the Poor. One of those little sisters is going to do a PSA for Trump.
Is she really?
Yeah.
So glad. Yeah. For her, that takes courage.
That takes courage, yeah. But then you have this, what we began with, this kind of silence on the issue of life in the election. Now, I just want the bishops to speak up loud enough so that voters, Catholic voters, will deal with this in their conscience. I'm not saying where they have. I'm not saying they have to come out one way or they have to vote one way. But I would like to know that our shepherds had spoken loudly enough that Catholics would consider this issue and not just ignore it.
I hope so too, but I'm not confident that they all will. But if enough do, and there are more and more every day, and Bishop Olmstead is just the latest who have, and you've been writing about some courageous bishops.
There have been a number.
I've been writing about some of the less courageous bishops.
But you know, this ridiculous ad campaign that Catholics for Choice did, where they published full-page ads in all the major cities.
Good for Cardinal Dolan. He refuted it.
Yeah, so did Archbishop Winsky. There were a number of strong responses, and that actually broke the silence. It gave many of the bishops an opportunity to come out and not to say, okay, this is about Trump and Clinton, but that to be for choice is not to be Catholic. You can't put those two things together. It's an oxymoron.
Right.
It's also moronic.
Yeah, I know. An oxymoronic. Tim Kaine's priest, though, giving him a standing ovation when he goes to Mass. Now, Tim Kaine, who has a 100% pro-abortion voting record, and I know it's just his priest, and his bishop kind of said, and you know, this isn't a good thing, DeLorenzo, I guess. But it wasn't strong, I didn't think. So Tim Kaine thinks he's a good Catholic, and that's all we read about, what a great Catholic Tim Kaine is, the vice president.
Well, that's because in 1980 he went on a Jesuit mission trip to Honduras.
Honduras, yes.
And that once you've done that, you're good for the rest of your life. You're a good Catholic for the rest of your life.
You don't ever have to do anything good for the rest of
your life. No. I mean, you know, all you see is Honduras and the Jesuits, and you're done. And I thought, God, I wish it was that easy for me.
Wouldn't that be nice?
You know? Of course, the only mission trip I ever went on as a Southern Baptist was to try to convert Catholics to being Southern Baptist to South Texas.
I didn't know that.
Back when I was a president of the Baptist Student Union at the University of Texas.
Wow.
I did confer a few, but I doubt if it lasted.
That's funny.
I gave the altar call on these poor little kids who didn't know what was going on. Oh, well, I was only 21. I didn't know better.
You were young.
You know who got mad at me was my Aunt Lucille, and she wasn't even Catholic. My Aunt Lucille was a great opera singer in her day, never married, great diva, and she, when she heard I had done that, it's one of the only times she got really mad at me. She said,
really?
They have their faith. What are you doing? I didn't really have an answer for it at the time. Oh, well, it's no more true confessions.
Okay. I had no idea about that.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, it's probably not a story I'm proud of telling. Talking with Ann Hendershot, who teaches both at Franciscan University and at King's College in New York City. Tell us about the Veritas Institute at Franciscan. What are you doing
there?
Well,
it's a group of faculty, and it's open to all faculty at Franciscan, who want to share ideas about how to bring Catholic social thought and moral teachings into the public square. So we kind of help each other with writing. We edit each other's work. We talk about ideas. It's really just to encourage people to write in the public square, to write op-eds, editorials, and help them get it published. And we started 4 years ago, and we have over 400 articles that we've placed in mainstream newspapers like USA Today, Time Magazine, Washington Times. Haven't cracked the New York Times. I don't think we ever will, because they're really not open to Catholic social teaching.
But you've got some very distinguished faculty up there, like Pat Lee and Scott Hahn.
We have wonderful people.
Who else is involved in the Veritas Institute?
Yeah, I feel very blessed to be there, and I don't say that lightly because, you know, I used to teach at the University of San Diego, which is a great place with great students, but in terms of a Catholic welcoming community, this is so much better for me.
Well, yeah, the University of San Diego hardly is the bastion of Orthodoxy, is it?
I know, and now they have a new bishop down there.
But it's so beautiful there.
It is so beautiful, and there are some very good people there. Our mission and ministry vice president is wonderful, Father Dillabaugh, Monsignor Dillabaugh. He's fantastic. It's just that there's such resistance from some in the faculty to all things Catholic that it's a problem. It really is.
But, you know, as you well know, there's a strong Orthodox Catholic community, a great Legatus group.
Great Scottish group. We've got Catholic Answers there, Carl Keating's
right.
group.
Right, Keating's right there in his airplane flying over the city all the time.
Wonderful.
Did you know that about Carl?
No, I didn't know that.
Oh, that's his passion in life, is to fly his airplane.
Really?
But I think everybody needs a passion in life, you know, other than our work.
I know.
You mean it's impossible to keep your sanity without something.
I think golf does that for you, isn't it?
I don't think there's any question about that. I think I make that pretty clear, too much to my detriment. But I don't apologize for it. It's, you know.
No, because it makes you who you are, Dale, and that's why everybody loves you.
A balanced human being, I hope, you know.
Yeah.
And my wife says, I always love it when you come back from the golf course. You're always happy.
Oh, that's nice.
So what's your passion other than all of this?
Well, every summer my grandson, he's 4 years old now, lives with us for the whole summer. Our daughter's a professor up in Boston. So the two of them move into our house, and we live right on the ocean here. It's the Sound in Connecticut in the summer. And that's my passion, the water. In fact, I'm looking at it right now. We live right on the water. And that's, I guess, my passion, just being with our dogs and family.
Well, you live up in Connecticut. It's a very beautiful place to live, and I'm sure you're very grateful for that. And I'm just sorry you had this commute, but I'm very glad that Franciscan University has you involved. It's a great school.
Well, I'm happy to be there.
And made greater by you being there, Ann.
Well, thanks, Dion. You're sweet. Thank you.
I've been talking with Ann Hendershot, professor at both Franciscan University of Steubenville and at King's College, eminent Catholic sociologist, whose books, particularly The Politics of Abortion, 2006, have had, you know, a lot of impact on me personally. But she also has a book on renewal, how the new generation of Catholic priests and bishops have revitalized the Catholic Church, which came out in 2014, and Status Envy, The Politics of Catholic Higher Education. We all know about that. Anne, thank you for being a guest on Church and Culture, and I look forward to having you back.
Thank you so much.
To all of you who are listening, after a short break, we'll be back with another wonderful guest.
In this year of mercy, Pope Francis encourages us to serve others. Catholic Charities of Southeast Michigan is working with parishes and schools on a day of service. Join us on Saturday, October 1st, to help the needy through local service projects. Save the date and roll up your sleeves by doing chores for seniors, stocking food pantries, and cleaning up neighborhood parks. Learn more about the projects in your area and register to help. Call Catholic Charities of Southeast Michigan at 248-537-3304 or visit ccsem.org.
The following is a message brought to you by the Catholic Biblical School of Michigan. In the Battle of Jericho, God commanded that the Jewish people process with trumpets, priests, and the Ark of the Covenant around the city that they might defeat it. It may seem beyond belief that a procession of worship and praise could bring down an enemy city's walls, but that's what we are told happened in Jericho. If obedient worship of God could destroy the strongholds of Jericho, can it not do the same for the strongholds we face? We're in a battle for souls, and worship becomes a powerful weapon in our hands. It may not be visible like a sword, and we may never see walls falling down like at Jericho, but worship unleashes God's divine power that overcomes our spiritual enemies. To learn more about how God leads us into the victory of salvation in Scripture, visit the Catholic Biblical School of Michigan on Facebook or at cbsmich.org.
Weekdays at 10 a.m., there's more to life.
Hi, I'm Dr. Greg Popchak.
And I'm Lisa Popchak. Each weekday on More to Life, we'll explore the life you were meant to live through the theology of the body.
Tune in for great advice, guests, and the information you need to take your marriage, family, and personal life to the next level.
Weekdays at 10 a.m. on Ave Maria Radio.
The Ave Maria Communications Guild invites you to activate your faith. The 2016 Triduum in honor of St. Therese the Little Flower will take place from September 29th through October 1st at St. Albert the Great Church in Dearborn Heights. The three-day event includes masses, special prayers, and veneration of a relic of the Little Flower. For more details, call 313-292-0430. Life Chain takes place nationally on Sunday, October 2nd. It is a quiet, prayerful witness of individuals and families standing along the sides of roads in cities and towns, proclaiming the truth and praying for an end to abortion. In Ann Arbor, the chain will be held at Huron Parkway and Platt, and in Detroit at Gratiot and Six Mile. Check out www.lifechain.net for more locations. You can find many more events and enter your own events at our website, avemariaradio.net. To become a member of the Guild, call 877-288-1077.
Light of the East, weekends on Ave Maria Radio.
I am Father Thomas Loya. This week on Ave Maria, fasting and penance is the way to prepare for any great feast. This includes confession, which is similar yet different to the form practiced in the Latin Rite.
Saturday evenings at 8:30 and Sunday mornings at 9 on 990 WDEO, Ave Maria Radio.
What would your mom and dad have done if you'd treated them like some of the things your kids do to you? I'm Dr. Ray Guarendi. Sometimes in counseling, I'll ask parents that, and they'll say, "Well, I wouldn't have done it." Why? "Well, I just knew." "You just knew what?" "That I'd better not." "Why?"